Some have come from quite a way to be with us tonight. We really appreciate that. And we give you a very warm welcome from the Adventist Church. Tonight, we're going to let Bob introduce the speaker in just a moment. But I thought it'd be good to find out a little bit about how you found out about this event tonight. And how come you chose to come through the advertising that we've been putting out. Because we need to know about how to advertise this sort of event in the future. So I hope you don't mind if I could just take a quick straw poll among you as to how you found out about this program tonight. There was adverts in the Strathallan News and the Strathern Herald. How many of you saw adverts in there and came because of that? Okay, a few of you did, thank you. What about, how many of you were invited by personal friends to come along? A few of you were? Okay, thank you. Great. And others may have received a letter, perhaps from Bob. How many of you received a letter from Bob? Quite a few of you did. All right, okay. And we've also been distributing some handbills in the community in this area. Did any of you receive a handbill and came because of that? Not so many. Perhaps it was raining rather a lot recently and not so many handbills got put out. I don't know. Did any of you see the posters that we put up around? Quite a few saw the posters. And we're glad that somehow or other you found out about this event. So I really appreciate that. Thank you for the time. So that we'll know in future how we can continue to advertise this. And perhaps some of you were given a slip of paper on the way in. And we're simply doing that because we find that we've been running these sorts of lectures on an annual basis. And some people are coming along for the first time and say, oh, you know, it would be nice to have known about these events before. And so what we do is we say, if you do fill out any details on that slip, we promise to use them appropriately, basically just to advertise this event if we're going to run it next year. And so if you have an email contact address or whatever you'd like to keep in touch, please feel free to do so. We'd also like to let you know that after the program tonight, we're going to invite you for some refreshments, some hot and cold drinks at the back there, some biscuits. And for those of you who would like to talk with Dr. John Walton, we will have an opportunity to continue the conversation that starts here in this program this evening. So you'd be very welcome to stay on for that. And so over to you, Pastor Bob.
Add my welcome. It was interesting to see that not many came through a handbill, so we can save ourselves a lot of walking in future. And obviously, I shall have to write more letters, as that seems to be a good way of doing things. And wasted £100 on the Strathallan News, I think. But it's good to know how you came, and that does help us. I'd like to welcome Professor John Walton. I don't know how many times we've been now, but this is the third year in a row, so we hope that this is an annual event. And I feel personally very privileged that we can have a person of John's eminence and knowledge to talk to us. I think that's a privilege, and I just wish we could fill the place for people to hear him. I think his talk tonight will help believers and non-believers. A believer, perhaps to strengthen our faith and when we have questions, because I think we all do get questions, it's nice to be able to strengthen faith. And if a person is sort of struggling, wondering about belief, then that is good. I think that they can also so listen. John is extremely busy, and he's just come back from about 5 days in Norway, and he wasn't quite sure what was happening there, but he was asked to give some lectures by a lady who has administrative connections with the Norwegian Mensa. So when he did his lectures, I think he found 150 people at least with Mensa qualifications. That's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? I asked when I could join, but I was turned down, so that no good on that one. Do feel free to have a drink afterwards and talk to John, and we look forward to hearing from you, and thank you for coming.
Just make sure I've got everything wired up. Good evening to you all. Nice to see so many of you here, and thank you very much for that nice introduction, Bob. I only hope I can live up to all of the good things you said about me. I was wise enough not to ask to join Mensa while I was there, I must admit. Yes, this is the third year in a row that I've been here to Crieff giving talks in the area of science and faith. I would like to hold my own straw poll and ask how many people here have heard me before? If you could raise your hand. Oh, a good number of you, yeah. Okay, so I can't be doing everything wrong or you wouldn't have come back. You know roughly who I am then, and you know roughly what to expect. Now, the subject tonight is miracles. Are they believable? You know, when a member of the secular public thinks about a miracle, what comes into their minds? Well, there are many preachers and teachers who claim to be able to perform miracles in the name of Jesus sometimes today. The God channels on the TV show some of these supposed miracle workers, sometimes in action. How impressive are they? One of the best known claimants to be a miracle worker in the United Kingdom is Archbishop Gilbert Deyer. He was ordained a bishop by the United Evangelical Church in Kenya, and he lives in the United Kingdom, and he runs the Gilbert Deyer Ministries with about 40,000 members. So that's more than the Seventh-day Adventist Church, for example, in the United Kingdom. Archbishop Deyer claims that through the power of prayer and the Lord Jesus, he can help sterile couples to give birth. Anne was one of the women that he helped, and she told her story to the Times newspaper. She suffered all her life from asthma and sickle cell anemia, she says, but she saw Archbishop Deyer on a digital TV channel, and as soon as she saw him, she was cured immediately, and she's never had any more problems. Then she became pregnant, and yet the tests by her GP and scans in hospital revealed nothing. They were negative. Her doctor told her she had a liver condition. She was convinced, however, that she was pregnant, and she consulted the Archbishop's wife, and she was told she was carrying a child. Her husband, James, said that he could feel the child moving and kicking. And Anne was growing really large, and people were saying, "When are you going to give birth?" She decided she'd fly to the Mamelusi Clinic in Kenya for a second opinion. She was told there, "Yes, you are pregnant," and on the 2nd of June, she gave birth. Joshua was born, but he was immediately taken by the police. "I've not applied for a passport to bring him home because I don't think the authorities will believe me," Anne said. "But he's my son, and I hate to leave him behind. Now I'm advanced in pregnancy again, but I took a test and again it was negative. Whatever comes to light during the police investigations, it's clear that Anne and her husband believe absolutely that she was pregnant and that she gave birth." Now, Anne is just one of many women in the UK who claim to have been helped by the Archbishop. Thanks to help from him and his wife, lots of women have given birth. One of the Archbishop's Kenyan flock is 56-year-old Edda Odira. She claims that she's given birth to 13 miracle children, some as little as 2 months apart. But the DNA tests found no link between any of the children and her or her husband. The Archbishop maintains that these are miracle babies with miracle DNA, so the DNA tests are not relevant. 50 families in Kenya have come forward claiming that their babies were either sold or stolen by the Mamelusi Clinic. In Kenya, the Archbishop and his wife are under investigation for child trafficking. He faces extradition to Kenya, but he's appealing on the grounds that he will be tortured if he goes there. Now, I think probably this is the kind of miracle story that members of the general public will think of if you say miracle. Perhaps also they might think of the infancy gospel of Thomas, That was in the news not so long ago. Not the gospel according to Thomas, but the infancy gospel of Thomas. That's supposed to date from the 2nd century of the Christian era. It tells stories supposedly about when Jesus was a boy. One story tells how Jesus was playing by a stream, and he built a dam there, and the waters collected into a pool. But as he was playing, the son of Annas the scribe came along, took a stick, broke the dam, and dispersed the waters. When Jesus saw what had happened, he became angry, according to the gospel, and said to him, I'm quoting here, "You godless, brainless moron, what did the poor ponds and waters do to you? Watch this now. You're going to dry up like a tree, and you'll never produce roots or leaves." Immediately, Anna's son withered up completely. Then Jesus departed and returned to Joseph's house. What do you think of that miracle story? Do you believe in that miracle? Is this a true account from Jesus' childhood? Well, I for one doubt it. It shows a vindictive and rather short-tempered Christ, does it not? At odds with the kindly Jesus that we hear about elsewhere in the authentic Gospels. This supposed miracle was just to gratify anger and pride. In fact, in a modern court of law, Jesus might be indicted for murder. Now, incidents like these make people very sceptical about miracle stories. When the man in the street thinks about miracles, these are the incidents that come to his mind. Can we blame agnostics? Can we blame atheists when they doubt? In fact, they're right, are they not, to question claims like these and label them as superstitions. Now, there's an added reason to doubt today, because many people think that science anyway has shown that all miracles are impossible and they are thoroughly debunked by the nature of science. From the 18th century onwards, particularly after Newton explained how the sun, the moon and the stars were governed by the laws of gravity, it became widely believed in Western culture that science had really proved miracles were impossible. The whole universe was believed to be a giant machine with interlocking parts that engaged perfectly and functioned by the regular laws of physics. In this Newtonian universe, a miracle would be like throwing a spanner into a printing press. There was simply no room for miracles and no room for the supernatural in such a universe. Oops, I've gone too far. Now, this worldview worked its way into every sphere of human endeavour, including, of course, theology and religion. Spinoza, 17th century philosopher, believed that nothing comes to pass in contravention of nature's laws. They're universal. We may then be absolutely certain that every event which is truly described in Scripture necessarily happened, like everything else, according to natural laws. Many theologians came to accept that miracles were impossible, and that miracles described in the Bible couldn't be actual historical events. They must be understood in some other way. Disbelief in miracles was the most important factor, not the only one, but the most important factor behind the suspicious and sceptical literary and historical criticism that relegated the Old and New Testaments to the status of legend and folklore. Probably this tendency reached its zenith with the tremendously influential German theologian Rudolf Bultmann. He said it's impossible to use the electric light and the wireless and believe in the New Testament world of spirits and miracles. Now, this kind of radical scepticism continues to this day. You find it, for example, in the work of the Jesus Seminar, which was founded by Robert Funk and John Crossan. The seminar treats the Gospels as artifacts, full of inventions and elaborations, introduced by the early Christian community to suit their cultural and social needs. Is such extreme scepticism really justified? Are we throwing the baby of faith out with the bathwater of superstition? Now, in the 1920s, the quantum worldview began to displace the Newtonian worldview, and it now dominates scientific thinking. Now, quantum mechanics is difficult to understand. Even Richard Feynman, a Nobel laureate in theoretical physics, said, I think we can safely say that no one understands quantum mechanics, and there's still a lot of debate about the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics. But certain facts are agreed. Quantum objects, that's things like electrons, can behave as both waves and particles. Now, this is counterintuitive. A thing is either a wave. A macroscopic thing, something we can touch and handle, is either a wave or a particle. It isn't both. So it's highly counterintuitive. Then the laws of physics are statistical in nature, so they can only give probability outcomes rather than a definite outcome for every quantum mechanical event or particle. Then there's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's not possible to know both the momentum and position of a quantum particle like an electron. So there are fundamental limits on what can be known. Then there's quantum entanglement. Quantum objects seem to remain linked, no matter how far apart they go in space. Einstein called this spooky action at a distance. Now, although the debate about the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics continues, there are, as I say, certain things that are agreed. There are no certainties in the quantum world. We can never be certain of things in the quantum world. The physical universe can, in any case, never be described completely. The universe is much stranger and more mysterious than formerly supposed, and the future is open. Miracles and the supernatural are certainly not forbidden. It's a fact that the Newtonian worldview has completely given way to the quantum worldview, although many non-scientists seem to be unaware of this, particularly in the media. Now, this doesn't prove, of course, that miracles can never happen. Sorry, it doesn't prove that miracles can happen, but it overturns the idea that science has disproved miracles. Science studies things that are regular and repeatable. Miracles don't fall into that category. By their very nature, they're unique and unrepeatable. The scientific method has no way of studying such things. They don't contradict science, they just fall outside its scope of reference, outside that particular frame. It reminds me of a story that I heard. It happened in the French Revolution. You remember there was a reign of terror during the French Revolution, and on this particular day they were guillotining people in the square in the middle of Paris. And this particular day, the first victim was a priest. He came along in the tumbril. They strapped him down on the guillotine, on Madame Guillotine, and they wound up the blade to the top, and then at the given signal the blade was released and it came crashing down, but it stopped just a few feet above the victim, and there was a gasp from the crowd. From the crowd. A miracle! A miracle! An act of God! He's a priest! Let him go! So they let the priest go. Now the next victim that day was a politician. So up stepped the politician, they strapped him down, wound up the blade. At the signal, the blade was let go and it came down and it stopped again a few feet above the man's head. And there was a gasp went up from the crowd. A miracle! An act of the devil! Politician! Now the third victim that morning, so they let him go. So they let him go as well. Now the third victim that morning was a scientist. So the scientist stepped up. They strapped him down, started winding up the blade. Now while they were winding up the blade, the scientist started sort of stretching his neck round a bit like this and having a look. And he said, "Ah, I see what the problem is. There's an obstruction a little way up there." Now I say nothing about the wisdom of that remark from him at that particular moment. Scientists have never been known for their political nous. But let me ask you a question. How did the scientist know that it wasn't a miracle? He looked, but what made him look? Curiosity, yep. There was something else, though. Any of you scientists?
Belief in the laws of physics.
Pardon? He believed in the laws of physics, but there was something else that clued him in. All right, but there's something else that clued him in.
He didn't believe in miracles.
Maybe he didn't believe in miracles, but why was there something particular in this instance that clued him in it was not a miracle? It happened more than once. It happened twice, once after another. Miracles are unique, unrepeatable events. The same thing doesn't happen immediately, straight after, one after another. That's what clued him in, although he may well have had the other qualities that have been mentioned. Okay, so science studies things that are regular and repeatable. It can't study things like miracles that are not regular and not repeatable. Now, many people still believe, however, even in the quantum world that we live in, that philosophers and logicians have proved that miracles can't happen. The most important of these was the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. He defined miracles as transgressions of the laws of nature by some invisible agent. Hume thought it was necessary to weigh the probability of a claim that a natural law had been broken, i.e. that a miracle had occurred, against all confirmations of that natural law. And the result would be that the alleged transgressions would always be ridiculously improbable, and therefore no rational person would believe in miracles. Now, by Hume's reasoning, we couldn't accept any amazing events from the past or present. We couldn't accept any of the amazing events from the life of Alexander or Napoleon because they'd be so improbable. We couldn't accept many things from everyday life. Here are some unique images that I got from the web. See that squash? It looks rather like a duck, doesn't it? But we know that squashes never look like ducks. Thousands and thousands of them have been grown. None of them has ever before or since looked like a duck, so we certainly can't believe that that is a true picture of a squash. Now, if you look very closely at that, in fact, if you look very closely at all those images, you'll see that they have been enhanced in certain ways. I'll leave that as a puzzle for you. However, I still think that that's a remarkable picture. Ditto with carrots. You can plant carrots day after day after day, hundreds of thousands of carrots. They don't grow to look like astronauts, do they? And yet here is a carrot looking like an astronaut. But according to Hume's argument, we could not possibly believe that a carrot would grow to look like an astronaut. Look at that picture of the eye. Now, is that a fake? Is that a fake or is that a true picture? Well, it's a true picture. It's a NASA picture. I think the colours have been added to it, but that is a real structure from the universe. It's from the Helix Nebula, and it's been dubbed the Eye of God. A very remarkable thing. Again, if we went by Hume's argument, we would automatically dub that a fake. Now, science also couldn't accept many of the things that naturalists believe in. For example, mixed proteins and DNA, and it's never been observed that a genetic code develops under any set of conditions. Yet, scientists want us to believe that. Thousands of experiments in which chemicals are mixed together have been carried out, and nothing has ever been produced that's living. So we couldn't accept the spontaneous origin of life either, by Hume's argument. In fact, Hume's argument is actually circular. He starts by assuming nature's laws are inviolable, and then he uses this assumption to show that the laws can't be violated. So in evaluating unusual events, the right approach is not to add up evidence, but to weigh it and sift it carefully. Your conclusion should be based on the reliability of the evidence and the witnesses. And a good dose of scepticism is healthy, because there are many, many false miracles about. I read this story on the web. There was a vicar, and he got a new little kitten. And the kitten, as they sometimes do, climbed up a tree outside his house, and it got stuck up the tree, you know, and how they mew pitifully when they're up there. And he tried to climb the tree, but he couldn't. So he got a rope, and he fixed it to the tree, and then he fixed it to his car, and then he drove his car, but unfortunately, the rope broke. And the kitten was catapulted over the houses and into the remote distance. He asked around in the neighbourhood, but nobody had seen any sign of this kitten. About 4 or 5 days later, one of his parishioners came up to him and said, "Pastor, you'll never believe what happened to me the other day. My little girl has been asking me for a cat for a long time, and I've always said no. I've always said no, but on this particular day I said, well, if God brings you a cat, then you can keep it." Well, my little girl went out into the garden, and she got down on her knees, and she started praying, and vicar, you'll never believe it, but this kitten came flying through the air, and it landed right in front of my little girl. Do you believe that? Well, I read that story on the web, so I can't vouch that it's a true story. It sounds a bit too good to be true, but the point I'm trying to make here, the point that I want you to notice is that no, if it was a miracle, no natural laws were broken. There was no breaking of any natural laws there. Kittens can be catapulted. They can land on their feet. Cats are brilliant at landing on their feet. There was absolutely no breaking of any natural law. If it was a miracle, then it was the timing of the thing that was the miracle. It just happened so pat, in answer, it seems, to prayer. So no natural laws were broken whatsoever. Many miracles fall into this category. I don't know if any of you remember George Muller, the philanthropist, worked in the Bristol area. And if you've seen his story, it's on DVD, or read the book, then you'll know that on several occasions, with his group of orphans, they sat down to breakfast. There was no food whatsoever in the house. George Muller said, "Let's say grace." And before they'd finished saying grace, there would be a knock on the door, and a basket of food would arrive. So no natural laws were broken, but the timing of the event is what makes these things into a miracle. Now, another form of objection to miracles comes from those who claim that whatever actually occurs in the natural world is a natural event. Some so-called miracles have actually occurred, but they must really be only natural events. There was a man, and he went to see his psychologist, and he told his psychologist that he heard a voice in his head claiming to be a being called Melazor. This Melazor said, "I'm a spirit surgeon from the astral world, and I'm going to train you to be a great healer." Now, the naturalist-trained psychologist doesn't believe in any such spirit visitation. He'll conclude this is a perfectly natural phenomenon. Physical or chemical trauma have caused the man's psyche to fracture, and he has a bipolar disorder, and Melazor is the creation of one malfunctioning part of his fractured brain. That's what will go into the account. However, this idea that whatever occurs in nature was caused by nature is a naturalist assumption. As an argument against miracles, it's circular, it just assumes what needs to be proved. It reveals an unshakable anti-supernaturalist bias. So, how can we tell the difference between a true miracle and a false one? In evaluating unusual events, the right approach is to weigh carefully up the evidence, sift it carefully. Your conclusion should be based on the character and reputation of the witnesses. Are they known to be truthful and honest people? Are their stories consistent? Do they contradict themselves or one another in any serious detail? Are they right about known places and events? What are their motives? Do they stand to gain from the stories that they're telling? Do circumstantial evidence and indirect evidence agree and form a logical, coherent pattern? Put all this together and then judge. Then judge how likely the miracle is to be true. Now, Norman Geisler drew up five characteristics that set a true miracle apart from a false one. First, a true miracle has an unnatural dimension. A burning bush that's not consumed, or fire coming down from heaven, or walking on water. They're not normal occurrences. Their unusual character commands attention. I read a story about a man, Chuck, his name was, and he was putting on weight. He decided he'd go on a diet to try and lose a bit of weight. And for a week or two, he kept to his diet, and everything seemed to be going well. But then one morning, he came into his place of work, and he had a big box of donuts in his hand, and his workmate said to him, "What? Where's your diet? What are you doing? You can't eat those donuts." "Well," he said, I've been longing for a donut for so long now, it seems so long, that this morning I prayed a prayer and I said, if God wants me to have a donut this morning, then when I drive past the bakery, there'll be a parking space right there in front of the bakery. And you know, he said, I only had to drive round the block 8 times and there was a parking space. So I feel justified in eating these donuts. Now, I don't know what you think about that miracle, but I would say that's not an unnatural occurrence at all. If you drive around the block 8 times, the chances of a parking space occurring are fairly good. So that particular thing, we can scrub that off as a miracle. Now, second, a true miracle has a theological dimension. It presupposes the theistic God who can perform these special acts. Then, a true miracle has a moral dimension. It manifests the moral character of God. God doesn't perform evil miracles because God is good, not like those miracles that I mentioned from the infancy gospel of Thomas about Jesus as a child. Then a miracle has a good or a just purpose. Unlike magic, miracles never entertain. They're not for entertainment. Their overall purpose is to glorify the Creator. Though unnatural, they fit into creation and befit the nature of the Creator. And then fifth, miracles in the Bible had a doctrinal dimension. They directly or indirectly verify a truth claim of one kind or another. They might show that a prophet was truly sent from God, or they confirm the truth of God through a servant of God. Now, some people criticise miracles on the grounds that, well, naive and mythologically minded people from Bible times believed in them, but we know miracles are never observed in advanced Western cultures today, so we can safely dismiss all these ancient reports. Now, it's easily shown that the majority of Western people in Western cultures do continue, actually, to believe in miracles. Here's the results of a Gallup poll from the USA in 1989. Respondents were asked, even today, miracles are performed by the power of God. And 82%, now this is the USA, admittedly, but 82% answered yes. Percentage would probably be lower here, but I'd be surprised if it was less than 40 or 50% in the UK. And then this Southern Focus poll, again from the USA, God answers prayers. 83% answered yes to that. Are you aware of an illness cured by prayer? 34% of people answered yes to that. Belief in the supernatural and in miracles is very widespread indeed in societies all over the world. There's evidence it's on the increase. Some of you in this audience may have experienced a miracle yourself. Now, it is true that there's a highly secularized academic subculture that doesn't believe in miracles. But it's only cultural elitism, academic cultural elitism, that imposes this on society as a whole. Now, it's interesting that even some academics have converted from a naturalistic worldview to one that's open to the supernatural. Often this was based on some undeniable experience that they personally had. Even Jesus Seminar members, Marcus Borg and Walter Wink, have come to be much more open to the reality of things beyond the natural order. Wink, for example, Walter Wink, had a religious experience that fundamentally altered his outlook, and he wrote, "As a result of my own experience, I'd no trouble believing in the plausibility of some events that to some of my fellow scholars simply seem impossible. Because of my experiences with spiritual healing, I have no difficulty believing that Jesus actually healed people, and not just of psychosomatic illnesses." There are well-attested modern cases of miraculous cures. I've just put a couple up on this slide here. There's the well-attested case, for example, of Jennifer Larkham. She spent 8 years in a wheelchair, crippled by pain and bodily malfunction from viral encephalitis. Medical sciences documented her plight. They could do nothing to cure her. After 8 years in this state, she was attending a religious meeting, and she was impressed by the testimony of one of the women there. She followed this lady out of the meeting in her wheelchair, and she insisted that the lady pray for her. Now, this lady had never healed anybody. She was hesitant to pray, didn't want to pray, but she did, and almost instantly, Jennifer Larkham fully recovered. She can now hold her wheelchair aloft. There she is doing it. She believes she was healed by a miracle of Jesus. Now, if you look in her secular records that her doctor keeps, I doubt very much you'll find under her cure, miracle of Jesus. You'll probably find in his notes, spontaneous remission or unknown causes. She believes, however, she was healed by a miracle of Jesus. Now, in 2001, at the age of 26, Justin Crockett was crippled by a muscular disease. He couldn't walk, he could hardly move his arms, he couldn't eat, couldn't read, couldn't write. All treatments from the medical profession had no effect. He tried a wide range of alternative therapies, none gave any improvement. He was assigned a carer. Now, in 2008, his carer, who happened to be a Seventh-day Adventist, invited him to some talks on Bible prophecy. he started going to the Seventh-day Adventist church and he asked to be baptized. He was baptized actually in his wheelchair. They lowered the whole thing into the baptistry. A few months later, Justin said, "I tried every medical intervention without improvement, and I began to accept that I would probably have to spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. I turned to Jesus and I asked him to help me accept the power that God gives to those who follow him." Justin was amazed at what happened, because immediately he was able to stand up and to walk, and in 2 weeks, remember, he'd not stood for many years, he was completely back to normal. He regained his strength in his arms and his legs. He could read and write again, and there is a picture of him in church. Yes, miracles of healing certainly do happen today. Now, what about Christ's resurrection? This is at the heart of the Christian gospel. Without it, Christianity really loses its central plank. In my opinion, I know not everybody shares that, but in my opinion, Christianity really falls apart without the bodily resurrection. Now, I was saying, let's weigh up the evidence and sift it. So let's do that in the case of Christ's resurrection. What is the evidence? Well, here are the eyewitnesses. He was encountered by many people over a period of about 40 days. And here are some of the eyewitnesses. Early on Sunday morning, he appeared to Mary Magdalene. Then he appeared to some more women returning from the tomb. He appeared to Peter later that same day. Then he appeared to two disciples going to Emmaus in the evening. He appeared to the group of apostles, except for Thomas, in one place. And then a week later, he appeared to the group of apostles, including Thomas. In Galilee, he appeared to seven disciples by the Lake of Tiberias. Then in Galilee, on a mountain, to the group of apostles and to a group of about 500 believers. At Jerusalem and again at Bethany, he appeared to James. At Olivet and at the Ascension, he appeared to another group of believers. Now, this is a large and impressive group of eyewitnesses. Nowadays, if we wanted to prove that the Christ that rose from the grave was the same person, we'd look for forensic evidence, wouldn't we? We'd like to be able to compare the fingerprints of the risen Jesus with the fingerprints of Jesus of Nazareth. Or, better still, we want a DNA test on Jesus who died and Jesus after the resurrection. We can't do that, unfortunately. But there is a kind of forensic evidence. And Thomas was the sceptical one. I don't blame Thomas at all for that. A resurrection had never happened before. Now, when Jesus appeared to Thomas a week later, he examined the forensic evidence. There were nail holes in Jesus' hands and a wound in his side. This forensic evidence showed that the man Jesus who'd been crucified was one and the same as the risen Saviour. It was this forensic evidence that convinced Thomas. Nor can we say that Christ rose in just a vision or a hallucination, or he was a spirit or a ghost or something like that, because he ate and drank with the disciples on more than one occasion. Luke recorded this. He said to them, "Why are you troubled? Why do doubts rise in your minds? Look at my hands and feet. It's I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have." When he said this, he showed them his hands and feet. And while they still did not believe, because of joy and amazement, he asked them, "Do you have anything here to eat?" They gave him a piece of boiled fish. He took it and ate it in their presence. Now, these weren't a bunch of credulous and naive simpletons. They were difficult to convince. They didn't believe to begin with. It took quite a bit to convince them. But they did conclude that the same Jesus they knew as a teacher in Galilee and elsewhere had risen from the grave. Now, many of this large group of witnesses lived for many years. They bore their eyewitness testimony even when persecuted and killed for their faith. Their lives were completely transformed. From fearful and doubting, they became bold and assured. Now, to me, one of the most impressive things about the account of Jesus' resurrection comes from those who changed their minds about him. I've already mentioned Thomas. Think of James, the brother of Jesus. He'd grown up alongside Jesus. They'd played together. He'd seen Jesus eating and drinking. He'd seen Jesus getting dirty and having to wash. He'd seen Jesus tired and asleep. He'd seen Jesus working at the carpenter's bench and obeying his parents' instructions. How could this brother of his be a great prophet, let alone the Messiah, the Son of God? Now, many of us have brothers and sisters. I've got a brother myself. We know them very well. We know all their habits and their foibles. What would it take to persuade you that your brother was a great prophet who performed mighty miracles or was the Messiah? Now, it would take an awful... My brother is a good guy, but it would take a lot to persuade me that he was the Messiah. But if my brother rose from the grave, I would re-examine my opinion about my brother. You know, at the start of Jesus' public ministry, his relatives, including James, were quite hostile to his mission. And I've put an account there. They went into the house, the multitude came together, they could not so much as eat bread, but when his own people heard, they went out to lay hold on him, for they said, he's out of his mind. Jesus, his mother and his brothers, they didn't believe in his mission or his messiahship. They wanted to persuade him to give up his public ministry, stop being an itinerant preacher. They cringed at his claims to be the expected Messiah. Now, it's very impressive to me that this changed completely after Jesus' resurrection. James was completely convinced, and he became one of the leaders with Peter of the fledgling church at Jerusalem. A letter that he wrote forms part of the New Testament canon. And we find James referring to his brother, as our Lord Jesus Christ in his epistle. He died for his belief in Jesus. It's even recorded in extra-biblical literature outside the Bible by the Jewish historian Josephus, and I've quoted there. He, Ananus, convened the judges of the Sanhedrin and brought before them a man named James, the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, and certain others. He accused them of having transgressed the law and delivered them to be stoned. He gave his life after the resurrection. Let's carry on weighing up the evidence then, and I'm coming pretty close to the end. There was a lot of circumstantial evidence, like the empty tomb, the scars in Jesus' hands and side that I've mentioned already. It explains how Christianity got started, difficult otherwise to explain that. The first eyewitnesses were women. You know, that's another very impressive touch. In that male-dominated society, women were not allowed to testify in court. Their testimony, you had to have two witnesses, and they had to be men. The testimony of women was not regarded as reliable enough to establish a fact in those days. Now, if the scriptural account had really been a fable got together by the early Christian church, they would never have chosen women as the first witnesses to his resurrection and as witnesses to his death on the cross as well. Never have chosen women in that male-dominated society. Now, I've mentioned the quality and quantity of the witnesses. The authorities weren't able to refute the disciples' claims. Thomas examined the forensic evidence, mentioned the changed attitude of Jesus' brothers. Many died in defense of their testimony. Now, it's true, some early Christians did break under torture, and they did sacrifice to Caesar. But none of them ever denied the resurrection or revealed any conspiracy. And then hostile Pharisee Saul became zealous believer Paul. A remarkably consistent and truthful picture emerges from putting all this evidence together. In coming to a positive conclusion, I think we can be confident that faith and reason are going hand in hand. Finally, then, there aren't any persuasive reasons from science, from philosophy, or from logic to prevent belief in miracles. Yes, scientists and non-scientists can believe in miracles with their rationality intact. A cautious approach is certainly justified, because there are many false and fraudulent miracles out there, and I've mentioned some of them. Some of these, in fact, quite a lot of them, are associated with groups claiming to be Christian. The extreme suspicion and skepticism, particularly of biblical stories, that's shown by the minimalist critics, isn't justified. Well-substantiated miracles can be accepted with perfect rationality. And the greatest miracle of all, the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, is one of the best attested miracles of all time. The biblical accounts don't bear the hallmarks of some clever, convoluted conspiracy. Christians can have confidence that the Jesus of Nazareth, who died on the cross, did emerge from the grave. He was a unique person in history. The central plank of Christianity is solidly based. It's as solidly based as it possibly could be. If this is so, I would say it's incumbent on us as individuals to weigh up his claims. What did he teach? What were his claims? What was his message? We should weigh this up very seriously too. You know, the message of Christ is one of hope. It's one of hope for the individual and of a better world to come. It's a very positive message. It's a very optimistic message. Every one of us should weigh up the evidence with the greatest care. Then Jesus told him, that's Thomas, "Because you've seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen, yet have believed." Thank you very much for listening.
Some of you may have questions, and so we thought, if it's okay, we can spend a few minutes at the end of the lecture taking questions from anyone who has any. So if you do, could you raise your hand? There's a roving microphone at the back there. There's a questioner just in the middle here. Thank you.
This is quite a theological subject, so I'm hoping I'll get some help maybe from the theologians if there are any questions like that asked.
There's a question coming from a scientist, a chemist, so maybe I can start putting your mind at rest. It seems to me that our human understanding of miracles has changed over the centuries. For example, hundreds of years ago, a miller looking at his sacks of flour, finding a rat emerging from one of them, would have said, "This is amazing, this is a bad miracle, a spontaneous generation." Now we know that rats live in flour mills and so on. We can take that a little further. The butterfly emerges from the caterpillar chrysalis metamorphosis, and we understand that now scientifically, though our forebears would have seen that perhaps as a miraculous process, something they couldn't understand. You have given some examples of things which appear to us today to be miraculous, healings and so forth. Do you think the time will come when science will explain these as science has explained previously considered miraculous events? And do you think there will come a time when there will be nothing considered miraculous because science explains everything?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. It often comes up under the title of God of the Gaps, and science is gradually narrowing the gaps down, and soon there won't be any room for God. I think myself that the quantum worldview has completely overturned that, because it's shown us that however hard science tries, the universe can never be described completely. You know, the idea of God of the Gaps is that there's some complete hole out there, and science has just got to fill in. There's some complete machine or some complete reality out there, and science has just got to fill in a few gaps. But in fact, science can never fill the gaps now because of the quantum universe. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the other things about quantum mechanics says that it never can be complete, our understanding of the universe. That's one point I would make. The other point is that people are now starting to ask questions like, where did the laws of physics come from in the first place? Why do we have a law of gravity that's an inverse square law? Why do we have a speed of light that's constant? Why are the cosmological constants, why do they take the values that they do take? And so science can understand, science can relate one kind of thing to another, but in looking to find some structure in the universe in the first place, science itself runs into an infinite regress. You know, always there's something beyond which can't be explained. We got to the point of the Big Bang, but then you start asking, well, what happened before the Big Bang then? And well, it was the Higgs quantum field that was there before the Big Bang. Well, where did the Higgs quantum field come from? Well, you might start talking about string theory or superstring theory or something like that. Well, where did the superstring theory come from? You're into an infinite regress, and you've always got to answer the question, why, you know, where did those laws of physics come from, and why are they exactly the way they are? So, in my view, you know, the God of the Gaps argument has lost its bite over the last half century or so.
One of the things you said on the screen was, no evil miracles. Are all miracles attributable to God, would you say?
Well, that's a very, very difficult question to answer, because it depends, you see, how you define a miracle. Now, I admit I tried to define a miracle, but there were some grey areas in there. Now, it depends whether you put the word genuine in front of the word miracle, in my view. There are false miracles that, to all intents and purposes, seem to be a miracle. You know, when you examine them, you examine all the facts, they seem to be a miracle, but there's something a bit wrong about them somewhere. So I'm backing away from saying that all miracles without the genuine in front of it are attributable to God, but all genuine miracles I think probably are. But there are some false miracles which appear to be miracles on the surface, but if we could examine more deeply, we might find something else underneath there.
As human beings, I think we are limited in what we can see. The electromagnetic spectrum is very large and we only see from, say, between 400 and 800 nanometers. Mm. So everything beyond 800 and anything below 400, we cannot see or touch, really.
Mm.
And therefore, we are limited as to what we can understand, I think.
Yes. Yeah, well, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. Are you saying that, therefore, we should believe in miracles, or therefore we shouldn't believe in miracles? Or therefore...
It's possible to have miracles, I believe. I do believe in miracles. And I've actually, well, in certain books, China, miracles have been happening, I know that much.
Yes.
And it's where people are persecuted, I think, that
yes.
miracles happen.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I agree entirely with what you say. There's been, scientific instruments have been developed to examine what goes on at the both ends of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can't actually see with our eyes. And a great deal is known now at the radio frequency end, and also at the at the X-ray and gamma ray end of the spectrum. But I mean, what's happening at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN is them pushing the limits of this even further. And as you know, they're looking for the Higgs boson there. There's still things to be discovered. And it's been very interesting recently. They're discovering all sorts of new things about the universe that we didn't know before. Just in the last few months, I've seen two amazing new... You alerted me to one of them. Amazing new bits of information that have been discovered. That one of the cosmological constants, the alpha constant, which measures the force of the electromagnetic force, varies along an axis going out into space. That was supposed to be a constant, and yet scientific papers are saying that there's a kind of axis in space along which it increases in one direction and decreases in another direction. This isn't science fantasy. This is something that's in the scientific literature. It has to be confirmed. But it's clear that there are things that science doesn't know. And if the alpha constant varies, then a lot of other things depend on that, like the speed of light, for example. Maybe that isn't a constant, and so on. And another amazing fact that I saw, again reported in the scientific literature, is that they found that the half-life of some radioactive elements varies during sunburst activity. I don't know if you saw that on the web. Now, the half-lives were supposed to be constants, and most of the radioactive dating methods are based on the idea that these were a constant. And yeah, I mean, it sounds like astrology, doesn't it, when you say sun activity. They think, however, you know, when there's a solar flare, a load of particles are given out, and they suspect that the radioactive element is maybe absorbing some neutrinos or some particles or something like that, and it's making the half-life vary. A lot to be investigated about this. It wasn't a huge variation, but it was measurable. So, you know, there's heaps of things still to discover. Certainly.
Any other questions? Question over there.
Now, this isn't my own idea, but nevertheless, I thought it worthwhile bringing up, is that, if you like, the, quote, miracle we're most familiar with is our own world, our own, in that we have, in this world, the perfect conditions for our development, for our evolution, and for our thinking about the nature of God, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
As far as we believe or think or can show, we're the only speck in this universe where this has been, where conditions have been possible for this to develop.
Yes.
You know where this comes from, of course. This comes from the Goldilocks Enigma.
Yes.
But it's which is an excellent book, but still leaves the same question. This is almost qualified, I think this is as near qualifies as a miracle as anything.
Yes.
Because there is no, as yet, explanation of any of this.
But yes.
It has happened this way. And we are here tonight because it's happened this way.
Yes.
Talking about the very nature of what our miracle is.
Yes, yes, yes indeed. I completely agree. There's a very good book pointing out a large number of those factors by Guillermo Gonzalez. It's called... Gone out of my mind. I'll try and think of that book. But he points out a large number of those factors. And really, the only escape for the naturalist from the conclusion that you're drawing and the conclusion that I draw from that is the so-called multiple universe hypothesis. You know, the idea that there are multiple universes which are kind of splitting off from our universe all the time, where the laws of physics are different and, you know, different kinds of beings and different situations arise. And that's become popular because, really, it's the only kind of out for naturalists.
Theoretical physicist, Big Bang Man and all that sort of thing,
yes.
Still expresses this incredulity,
yes.
At the very thing which he's not able to explain.
Yes, yes. I have that book at home. It's,
yes,
it's a good
indeed.
Book.
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah, thank you.
Not Pam, the author.
It's Paul Davies.
Paul Davies.
Right.
Paul
yeah.
Davies,
yes. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for you, if there's nobody going to ask me any more questions. How, as a man, how can a woman believe she has given birth to a child when she hasn't? Can somebody answer that question for me? I mean, giving birth to a child is a tremendous physical, emotional, spiritual experience. And yet, they're investigating quite a number of these women and the Archbishop for child trafficking. But how can she believe she gave birth to a child when she didn't? That's the question I have.
Personally, I would think only because she is, want of a better word, she is ill in some way. Because that's a personal experience of mine, not to give birth to a child. But I, unfortunately, last year had a rather bad accident on a mountain and damaged my spine. I had to have an operation. And whilst in hospital, I had all kinds of incredible hallucinations
right. That
I quoted to my wife as though they really had happened.
Right, yeah. It's a fact.
And she said, but they haven't, you know. And I said, they have, I know.
Quite
you
hard
know.
To convince them.
Yes, quite right. Hard to convince me these things have not happened to me.
Right, yeah. It is a fact that at the Mama Lucy clinic in Kenya, during the birth, that the ladies are sedated. So that does add a slightly different dimension to the whole thing. But still, I feel if I had given birth, even under sedation, I would know about it, wouldn't I? Wouldn't I? Maybe I wouldn't. Sorry, we can't believe
it. It's interesting that they've gone to another country to give Kenya to have.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No. Yes, that story gives a whole different dimension to the understanding of phantom pregnancies, doesn't it? Is there another question? I think just before the end, sorry.
Perhaps not so much a question as an observation. It seems to me that our lives are much enhanced by the concept of the miraculous. And we all have different perspectives on what goes on around us. Maybe not so much the babies appearing in Kenya or not, but rather here in Crieff. There are things which appear to be miraculous, whether they are or not. And I think this greatly enhances our life experience. And I would commend to people to look for the miraculous and to be aware of the possibilities of it happening. And I think our lives would be greatly enhanced.
Thank you. I think that's a very perceptive comment, and I agree with it really wholeheartedly. I think it's very, very true. It can be a very life-enhancing experience, and it's a great shame to let the sceptics, to let the naturalists, to let the doubters rob you of the experience that you've had. Okay, a healthy dose of scepticism. Okay, weigh the evidence carefully, even in the case of your own life. But having done that, don't let the sceptics rob you of that wonderful experience.
Thank you. For many of us who are here tonight as practicing Christians, of course, we are very keen to be assured that there is a space for miracles in the world as we understand it. For many of us, an understanding of the miracle that took place when Jesus was raised from the dead is the core understanding of what a miracle is really all about, that normal principles of life, as far as we know it today, can be superseded in special circumstances, and there is a God above all who is able to understand the laws of this universe in such a way that for him it wasn't a miracle. For him, he was just doing his job. But for us, who have to live by the natural laws that we live under, it will be regarded as a miracle, and we can thank God for that. So I'd like to thank you very much, John, for assuring us tonight that that what we see is not all there is, and that there is a God beyond who can understand and understand this universe far better than any of us can. So we'd like to thank you again for coming tonight, and to invite those of you who'd like to stay behind for some refreshments to do so, and we'll continue the conversation there. Thank you very much.